Welcome to the Unhooked Podcast, hosted by author, writer, and recovery advocate Annie Highwater. This is a podcast of real conversations and true stories from those who have been affected by and overcome adversity. Each episode will tell real, raw, sometimes unbelievable stories, opening up the lives of a variety of guests, as well as your host. You will hear stories of despair, recovery, and triumph from people who have risen from or are making their way through wilderness experiences. The goal of the Unhooked Podcast is to take a deep, productive look into topics related to addiction, alcoholism, grief, mental and emotional health, family dysfunction, codependency, conflict, and other types of affliction. The good, the bad, the dramatic, the real life stuff that all of us face. You will hear wisdom and hope from people who are fighters, who fought to persevere through bewildering circumstances and difficult obstacles. You can contact Annie by emailing annieunhooked@gmail.com. And now, enjoy the show.
Okie doke. Well, thanks for listening, everyone. I have a special podcast planned for today. I wanted to do kind of, I started with the subject of dealing with aggravation and aggravating people, which is something we all go through in daily life or families. But it kind of expanded to almost the concepts of healing, recovery, things we've learned, self-progress type of boot camp conversation that I was beginning to put together. So I wanted to have my brother's friend, Ben, come back on the podcast. He's been a favorite over the years. If you haven't heard the episodes with him, go back to the earlier ones or search whatever podcast platform you listen on with my brother's friend, Ben. We have pretty robust conversations and have for years about all things that work with health, fitness, life struggles, just every kind of topic of concern. He's become a great source in my life, of my small inner circle, someone to turn to. We don't always agree or follow the same paths or plans, but just tremendously helpful and comforting. Ben has been someone who has consistently spoke truth and hope, healthy ideas, new ideas into my life. I hope vice versa a little bit. He's really become another brother to me. I want to kind of tell the quick story again of why I call him my brother's friend, Ben, instead of my friend. I met him when I was about 15 years old, and he was one of the closest friends of one of my four older brothers. So he was around quite a bit, and we had a lot of conversations in common, and I really liked him almost on a sister level. I have another sister, and when both of us are real familiar with, when you grow up with a lot of boys, you tend to have friendships that are almost like a repeat of your situations with your brothers. So he became that in our family. And then I went through a period of sort of legalistic kind of religion and got real careful about how I was perceived to other. I really wanted to get it right. And at the same time, my husband was not going in that direction with me. So he had been pursuing ministry and decided he was going to kind of leave the faith. So I kept my son and I in it, going to church, all of those things. And in the process of divorce, I wanted to keep every area of life as clean and holy as possible. Not just looking, but I was really trying to do it. I wouldn't ride in vehicles with anyone that was a male that wasn't a family member alone, things like that. So that said, when Ben was around and we would go to church events, this is dumb now and I'd never do it now, but I would call him my brother's friend, Ben. And just instead of just saying my friend, Ben, so that people would not assume that I was going through a divorce or that I was a single woman hanging out with this potential romantic partner. Plus, he had had a relationship in his life, and I was paranoid about creating the wrong idea with people. Now I'm a little more leaned back, and I trust that my character speaks for itself. I don't have to display it for others. But long story short, that is why I call him my brother's friend, Ben. And with that said, I want to welcome him on. I just want to add a quick note as well. I have as much respect and admiration for Ben's wife. I think that a lot of male-female friendships, as you mature and grow, you can't really have a brother-sister male-female relationship with just anybody if there's relationships involved. We've always kind of had the respect to where if someone in my life was bothered or if someone in his life is bothered, I'm not going to say, oh, well, our friendship's more important, because to me, it's kind of been like, well, screw the friendship. Your relationship matters a little bit more, especially if it's a long-term partnership or marriage. So there's always had to be that respect level. That respect level's been, I believe, intact with Ben's wife, but even more so that she is just one of the most incredible, admirable, fighter spirit type of people I've ever met. So sorry for the long introduction, but I'm trying to wrap it up and bring it forward to today. And with that said, Hi, Ben. Welcome.
Hey, that was a great introduction. It's probably going to be downhill from here.
Did I miss anything?
No, it was pretty good. Yeah, a lot of mutual feelings. I can't put it as good as you did, but I feel the same way about you as a lot of things you said.
Oh, well, thanks. Well, I just kind of want to get right into it because we tend to keep it moving really well. One of the things that we were talking about recently was advice you gave to me when I was on a trip, and this was some years ago. We do have in recovery, and Ben and I kind of discussed this as well, a no advice rule, and that works in my work as well. I don't really know what someone's going to have to face or what consequences are going to come about if I give somebody advice, if they take my advice. Maybe it works for me and it doesn't for them. So I don't ever like to give advice. I like to say what worked for me or what didn't, and then you kind of make your own choice. So we've kind of been real respectful about that. However, you do give great tips and suggestions. And one of the things that sparked this conversation was I was in a pretty bad struggle on a trip and surrounded by a lot of people. We were together for a couple of weeks, kind of a retreat situation. Not trying to make anybody look bad, but you know, personalities will start to bump up against each other when you're in one close quarter section and you're spending time, events, meals together. You start to kind of rub each other the wrong way. I began to be triggered by a couple of people who were just kind of polar opposites of what I'd grown up with, what I was familiar with, what I was comfortable being around. So I had sent Ben a message and just said, I hate it here. I'm kind of struggling. Told him a couple of the dynamics, you know, always willing to bring it back to where am I wrong or whatever, but I need to vent. And that was when you gave me some really good advice. So if you want to kind of take that away.
Yeah, before I do say that, I just want to start the whole thing off on, I'm going to say a lot of stuff here and come off like I got everything all figured out, but I don't. I have to apply everything I talk about like daily, hourly, by the minute. It's easy for me to get off track. I have to constantly be observing how my thoughts are going and, you know, pull out of it and reframe it or get on a positive note. So, and most of the stuff are somebody else's ideas. I was just smart enough to listen to them than apply them. So sometimes I've tweaked them, you know, to my thinking, but just want to throw that out there. And then this piece of advice, what you're talking about, I got that nugget right before you went on vacation. So I was just learning it. And this has been one of the best lessons in recent times for me, because I struggle with getting along with people or letting people get on my nerves and stuff. So this has been a great one for me, just this whole mindset. And I was listening to Jocko Willink. He's got podcasts and he's on YouTube. And this is where I got it at. And I advise anybody that's interested in that, look him up on YouTube, or you can just look at any podcast thing, and especially pay attention to one called Good. Watch that video. It's only a few minutes long, but it's good advice. But anyways, on the podcast, he was saying that James Stockdale, I don't know if anybody remembers, he was ran for vice president when Ross Perot was running. It's been a while, but anyways, he was shot down and captured during the Vietnam War. He was a prisoner of war for 7 years. So I guess while they were prisoner there, they would get new cellmates every few months. Sometimes it might go a year, but they're always rotating them around. So obviously when you're living with someone 24/7, you know, it's going to be rough. He came up with a rule because he had got into stoicism, which I'm a big fan of that too. If anybody's into that, you know, do your own research and look into it. But there's a lot of good ways of thinking in stoicism, but he had got into stoicism in college. So he came up with this rule. If a cellmate does something that gets on your nerves or annoys you, that's your own fault. That's on you. And that's pretty much extreme ownership, which Jocko Willink talks about all the time. And then clearly a stoicism lesson he had learned. And so another example is like Joe's my cellmate. He's picking his toenails in the bunk above my bed mm-hmm. every night. That's annoying me. Well, that's my fault. I need to readjust my thought pattern and not let his actions annoy me. And he probably got some of that thinking from Epictetus. He was a stoic that has mm-hmm. all kinds of quotes or whatever. And he had a quote talking about, remember, when you take offense, you're compliant and being offended. Every situation, we have freedom of choice. Focus on what part is up to you to control. So just adding that to my life has been good. I'm not letting people bother me. As soon as I catch them getting on nerves, I can, you know, pull back and apply this lesson to me or whatever, you know, that I'm the one at fault here. I don't care what they did. I need to take action and I don't need to let them control me. And it's not even personal. I like to take things personal too. This is something they got going on. They're just applying it to me. So I need to always remember that.
Right. Yeah. That was so helpful because I was thinking, oh, if my cellmate is annoying me, it's my fault. It's my problem. Maybe I didn't cause it, but the only thing I can do is come back and work on why is it bothering me? What's it reminding me of? What's it triggering me to want to do? A lot of it was really extremely vulgar conversation, and especially back and forth with kids and stuff. And that's just so that about puts me through a seal, through the ceiling, especially when we all are part of our backgrounds and what we marinated in as kids. You know, my dad never cussed in front of me, never sexual jokes or anything like that. So I'm extremely uncomfortable when there's like teenagers or kids in the room and that stuff's free flowing. I just want to die. That was kind of specifically what was happening this on this trip years ago. I got your advice and I immediately was like, oh, that's, you know, that's that extreme ownership. What can I do? I can walk away from the setting. I don't have to be a part of it. I can get up and take a breath and walk away. I can talk to somebody else. I'm not going to go in and change somebody's life or pathology or how they perceive things. I mean, it really, I don't even know if you noticed or were aware, quickly woke me up. And I remember telling you, I could have let it ruin this entire 2 weeks and that would have been really miserable. Every encounter and situation and even planning events that day would have been infected by it. And that was my own, that would have been my own doing. Unless I kind of woke up to it and said, okay, what's the best way to make this about me and what I can control?
Yeah, it's probably stuff you already know, but in a certain way, maybe not phrase exactly like that, but it just came at the right time. And like I said, it was fresh when you heard that. And I just told you about James the Stange Doc Dell story. And I didn't say it as advice or anything. I just told you about the podcast and all that. And then take that information, do with it what you want.
I
gave other people what I've considered good advice. And I felt like it fell on deaf ears. Like you could lead a horse to water, but you can't make them drink. But you were smart enough to, you know, take it in for what it was and then apply it, you know, because I feel like you got to be smart enough to take the advice too. It's on both ends.
Smart enough or desperate enough. And in recovery, they say you can lead a horse to water, you can't make them drink, but you can give them peanuts and make them thirsty. So that makes them kind of want to search out their own truth. That was like giving me hope that there's a solution to this, that because I don't want to be miserable. I don't want to walk around in a steaming mood. I want to come out of it as quick as possible. What's the solution? And so you said, if your cellmate's annoying you, and I just applied that right to me, who are my cellmates? And that, you know, segues into every area of life. I've got difficult family members, a couple in particular that are prone to high conflict, constant conflict. And I just bring that back to me. If it's happening and it's annoying me, it's my problem. It's my problem to solve. And I can only solve it in my own arena. You know, with that said, that was such good advice. It really broke me free from a mindset I was heading toward. So I just kind of want to get into the experiences we've had of overcoming those types of situations and the things and situations and stories we tell ourselves. And I don't know if you'd be, you know, comfortable sharing, but you and your wife had recently gone on a trip to Hawaii. And I loved the story you told about a guy that you completely took wrong, the vibe you were getting from him, and had an entire storyline going for yourself. And it turned out different. So if you wouldn't mind sharing that.
Yeah, I hope that don't come off like a humble brag, but I mean, this is just what it is. I'm a very defensive person. So just based on my childhood and things, very defensive still. I've worked on it, I'm way better, but still way more defensive than a regular person and way more like ruminating thoughts, probably taking things the wrong way and being defensive than a normal person, which, you know, I don't want to be that way. I'm working on it. But this is an example of how my mind works or whatever. So I'm on vacation, like, you know, I was in paradise and we were even staying in, like, you know, above our pay grade type of resort. It was a real nice resort. So there was like a lot of type A alpha males running around there and just a little bit more successful people in life, it seemed to me, just kind of doing people watching around the pool and just observing everybody and listening to conversations or whatever. It was a little bit higher pay grade than we were used to, which it was nice. It was great service and everything. So I'm laying around there all day and there's all these guys that look like they're older guys and that work out and they, you know, had a lot of muscle on them, pretty fit, you know, and a lot of type A, like businessmen probably are driven in a lot of ways like that. You know, they probably take their physical and everything. They're working out. They're just hard charging type A personalities. So that's how I was looking at it. And probably the most fit and the biggest one there, I noticed him at the pool. And, you know, you're laying around the pool quite a bit in the evenings, just kind of people watching and checking out the pool and the ocean. And I got fair skin, so I had like a hat on all day and like a sun long sleeve shirt all day, just because I don't want to get sunburned. I don't like putting chemicals on me too, the sunblock, and then the other kind with the zinc, you're all white and stuff. So I just rather just wear clothes and be a little warm. So finally it was getting hot and I knew the sun was starting to go down, and, you know, I was going to swim and stuff, so I didn't need to worry about getting sunburned at that point, and took all my stuff off. Got pretty lean. I'd done a lot of, thanks to you too. So like you were a lot of help in that, really making me think about doing carnivore and keto a little bit further into it than I was doing. And it certainly was a good tool to get me where I wanted to go. And also the giving up drinking, which you were a big influence on that, which was a big help. I was already heading that direction, but you probably pushed me to get a little bit sooner. But that also, the calorie deficit and just, I don't know, the focus and everything, it was just way easier to get leaner when you're not drinking.
Right.
I seem to obsess on anything I get into. So if I'm drinking, I'm trying all kinds of different champagnes and beers. And, you know, I just get real obsessed with trying different ones because I enjoy, you know, my palate, but it's a lot of empty calories. So that all got me to a point where I was pretty lean and ripped, and I've worked out my whole life. So I got a pretty decent amount of muscle. I take off my shirt, and I see people, because I've been laying around that shirt all night. I'm getting a lot of looks. People are looking at me. For a 54-year-old man, I'm built pretty good, I'll say.
Well, it was pretty noticeable, too. You would lean down, and it looked like somebody who, in my opinion, when you posted it, looked like one of those, like, extreme elite athletes at that time.
Yeah, I appreciate it. But so, I see that guy. He's probably the most fit one there. He's big, and he's pretty lean, leaner than a lot of the guys there. And he's just kind of, I see him eyeballing me, and I see him saying something to his wife, and I see her looking right at me. It was pretty evident. He's saying something about me, and then she's looking as he says something, and they're, like, looking at me. So I'm not too worried about it. It's not ruining my vacation or whatever, but in my mind, I'm going, man, what's this? Dude, I'm 54 years old. You're probably about 40. You're like, you know, you're in your 200 some pounds massive. You're way bigger than me. And, you know, you ain't as lean as me though. And I bet you can't, I'm thinking, I'm already putting nerves because we just gone on a big hike and I got good cardio. I was thinking, dude, if you tried to even match me on a hiking trail, I'll smoke you. I'm thinking, but I know in a way, yeah, I mean, this is all internal. And I'm just running this little dialogue, but I mean, obviously you could lift more than me and, you know, you're way bigger and all that or whatever, but I don't even know why you're even making, you're looking, you know, sizing me up and talking about me, your wife, and making this something, it's not something. Cause I've seen like plenty of other people looking and, but not like, make it any kind of, you know, nobody's pointing, making it obvious they're talking about me. So
but
anyways,
I'm challenging you to a duel and kind
of sort of in my mind, I'm taking it right. That way. And I think that way a lot. And I use it to my advantage. Like in the gym, I'll motivate myself, or on a bike trail, if somebody passes me, I'll take it as like, oh, he thinks he's in better shape than me. Or even on a hiking trail, whatever. I got to use like what Michael Jordan did, just create some enemy in my head to make push myself and use it for a drive. And it works for me. You know, maybe it's not the best headspace to be, but I actually enjoy it and it's fun for me. So if that makes any sense. But in this case, I wouldn't say it was fun or I was enjoying it, but I wouldn't get miserable and ruin it. I was just doing a quick scenario that might, you know, this is just the dialogue in my head real quick. So we're going to dinner later that night. It's been a couple hours and we're changing, cleaned up, bra and dress clothes. And we're walking down the steps to get in the car to go out to dinner. And here they come, the guy and the wife. And he stops me. He goes, Hey man, how old are you? And I'm like, man, I'm 54 years old. I'm still a little defensive. And he's like, man, I was just telling my wife out there how great, dude, you done a great job, man. You got a great physique. And he's just going on and on about me, which is, I wasn't expecting that kind of high praise from a guy. I expect maybe from somebody that just don't do anything, that they're out of shape, you know, because I'm kind of skinny, you know, and looking at me and think, well, that guy's in shape. But I wasn't expecting it from like the most fit guy there to be giving me that kind of high praise. So that really caught me off guard. You know, just another example of like, it was a whole 180 of what I was, the scenario I was painting in my head, that, you know, this guy's hating on me, you know, and I don't, for what reason was he hating on me? There's plenty of other people in here in worse shape than me. Talk about them. But in fact, he's looking at the opposite or whatever. He's, you know, he's thinking I'm doing great. He was just praising me. And then I went on about him and he's talking about how he used to bench 500 pounds and he's currently 6'4", 260 with a 34-inch waist. And I don't think he was lying because it all looked to be true. Like I said, he was in really good shape. So that was high praise coming from a guy like that. And it's just a good thing that I already know about myself. It's just another example about creating false scenarios in my head. Yeah. And I think I'm right a lot of times. I still go by that. I really feel confident when I'm sizing people up, I was right. But this is an example where I was wrong. So I'm probably wrong more than I think.
But, you know, I think we all are, because it's almost that like survival storyline, but adding past experiences and whatever kind of fear. I mean, there's a whole recipe for the direction it can go. But those thoughts, offenses, or the direction they take, they can absolutely take over and they can consume you.
Agreed.
Yeah. So, I mean, I've had that happen, you know, pretty regularly where you start to sense something, and discernment's important. You know, we've both read Gavin DeBecker's work, The Gift of Fear. Awesome book. I read it about every 2 years, about trusting your intuition and not just walking around with your keys in hand, ready to be attacked in a parking lot, because your intuition's sensitive and it's there for a reason. That's true. But when we start getting in our head, offenses that work itself up into a whole storyline, and it's usually an internal attack and harassment, that's when it's like, I got to step back from this. This is a different thing.
Yeah, I can use it to my advantage when I'm in a gym or on a bike, and that's real positive. It gets my endorphins flowing, gets me hyped up to push. But like when I'm just laying around the beach, you know, relaxing, I don't really need that. You know, so it wasn't really serving me anyway or whatever. But I try to keep that little scenario in mind all the time. But
how your thoughts can just take you like running on a trip.
That's what I say. You got to always be monitoring them and kind of pull back and then reframe and restudy. If you find your mind going there for a long while, you got to be constantly monitoring your mind, like watching what's going on there as though you're like watching yourself from above or something.
It happens to everyone. And I don't think for the most part, I don't know if people are aware of it or as transparent about it. You know, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah. I think sometimes it's awareness, you know?
Yeah.
You're just caught off in the storyline of life. And you're just react. You're not stopping and thinking, well, why am I reacting or how am I feeling? Or what's going on here?
Those things mushroom cloud. And if you parlay them into the recovery world, whatever, you know, side of the recovery house you're on, I work in a therapy setting, but I also do a lot of recovery work in the rooms of family members who have a husband, wife, son, daughter with an alcohol problem or active addiction or are grieving someone they lost to that. You hear quoted thoughts about the mind all the time. My mind's like a bad neighborhood. I never go into it alone because your mind will just take off running on you. And it's not even about what others might be thinking. It's always the worst case scenario. Your mind tends to glom onto that, especially if you've got a fear-based situation. There's been, you know, times I haven't heard from my son in a what I feel is a reasonable amount of time to respond. And I have him off on a type of relapse, off on a bender. I have him chained up and kidnapped by cartel. Like I have absolute worst case life and death scenarios going on in my head. And they take over to where I'm sick with them. And I've had to kind of learn to reel those back in and look at patterns, look at reality, look at information I actually have. And if none's come in, it's a talking yourself down off of that. So there's all levels of that. And it just kind of depends on what you're dealing with, I think. I was making a point recently to someone that when you're going through drama or you come from trauma, you can become really narcissistic because your thinking takes over, you know. But I've learned, I was listening to a teaching by Brene Brown that was talking about how we're so not in tune with being honest about how everything is emotions. You know, even David Goggins says everything is in life comes down to how you're feeling, but people act like that's such a weak, taboo conversation. But if you're in an airplane and all of a sudden you get the notion that it's going down, you'll feel your pulse rate go up. You'll feel sweat start to happen. You feel yourself get lightheaded. Those are feelings that alert you to threat, danger, situation. You know, if you drop a bowling ball on your foot, where does all your thoughts go to? The area that's in pain. So, you know, there's different measurements of that. If you have pain from a painful past or background, you're going through a divorce you maybe don't want, you got a kid out in active addiction and you're climbing the walls, walking the floor at the midnight hour, you tend to be narcissistic in your thinking and those things can bloom large. And you almost, I would say, you can't come out of that on your own without some sort of tools, help or support to redirect you. So there's big and small versions of this.
Yeah, I have one more thought on this subject of like what I was talking about, like observing your mind or whatever. And because I do all this all the time, if I find myself like looking back a lot of times, like thinking back about a lot of times when you start to think back, it's about a lot of past regrets, how you didn't do this right or you didn't do this right. I think that's for most people. So when you're going back thinking that, it's kind of like depression. You're thinking about things in the past because, I mean, it's over with. You need to move on. That milk's spilt and just do better going forward. You got the lesson out of it. Who cares? You're going to make mistakes. There's more ahead of you. It's mistakes, but you're going to learn from that and get better. So you got to try to pull back and live in this moment. Forget about that. And then you go the other way. You start thinking about planning all this stuff. Like, well, Tuesday, I got to do this. Wednesday and tomorrow morning. And I'm a planner. So I can get way ahead of myself in planning and thinking about things and trying to get things done. You know, I make all these lists and scratch things off what to do and keep caught up. And well, that creates anxiety when you're looking towards the future. So you get anxious. So I got to remember that too. I can't be looking ahead. I can't be looking forward. I got to do a little bit of both, but I can't be doing a lot of both. I need to kind of stay grounded in the moment. And saying that seems really easy, but for me at least, it's hard to stay there in the present moment without either mainly going forward. I'm thinking forward a lot. Thankfully, I'd rather be looking forward than back. But like I said, that creates a little bit of anxiety.
And too much dwelling on it in any direction, even like nostalgia can be a great liar and make you think there were better days behind you when you had similar struggles back then, or that you've already had your best years behind you and you'll never achieve or go for or have a certain family or career or whatever. All of those things, your mind will lie to you in the past and it will lie to you about what's ahead. So it's absolutely vital to stay in the day. Like in running, and I've applied it to recovery when things are bad, I was given the advice, run the mile you're in. When you're training for a marathon, stay in the mile you're in. Don't think about the miles behind you because they might have been too easy or really difficult. And don't think too far how much is ahead of you. Just stay in the mile you're in.
Yeah, good points.
Yeah. So along with that, just the experiences, I just have a couple of notes here because these are all things we all struggle with. I have a bruise that I tend to have returned to and needed help with. And I think I've come a million miles, but nobody becomes immune to their pathologies. You still sometimes have things pop up, even if you have a lot of recovery work under your belt and tools and momentum. As I had a lot of social trauma just coming from a family that was condemning, super dysfunctional. I mean, you know all that. Most people know all that. That's in my first book, Unhooked. I was raised with a theme of our conversations and connections were all centered around ridicule. And there was a kind of a church aspect to it, not a loving, kind of Christianity, but more of a, you're going to hell. Every disagreement is probably demonic. You're bad and you're not just bad, but if you're disagreeing with me, God agrees with me. So God and your eternity is against you. So it was a big dynamic to take onto a young child's mind, a big weight to carry, to walk out of all of these things. But the ridicule part was really, it's been a lifelong problem for me, whether it's been me thinking I have a good connection with somebody that I'm just super sarcastic with, and then I find that it's empty, or, you know, when somebody's like funny and they're funny and they're funny and then they're not, it's not funny anymore. And all of a sudden your feelings are hurt or you're kind of ticked. I would have a lot of those situations that I either did or were done toward me. And then I became real sensitive to ridicule. And that's just a mess when your life kind of revolves around bonding with people in that way. But I remember one time I was telling you about dealing with that with a family member who lives for that. And they take kind of passive aggressive shots at you. And it's all the time. And you gave me a really good perspective about ridicule. You said it's conflict. Ridicule is conflict. And that kind of bloomed large in my mind because I completely saw it different after that, from that day forward, that, oh my goodness, this isn't just riffing. I'm not just taking it wrong or too sensitive. And that person maybe isn't just taking it wrong or too sensitive when it's coming from me, but we're engaged in conflict. So anyway, if you want to just run with that, because I love that conversation we had.
Only thing I can think about is I used to be into like picking on people and going at people just to basically for fun for myself the past time. I got a sharp tongue and I got a quick mind, so I can really start cracking on people and, you know, kind of making their life miserable, and I'm good at all that or whatever. But, and we'd all be having fun, the people that are around, because I'm doing it kind of for them too, putting on a show. But the guy who's getting picked on or whatever, you know, I'm getting him stirred up or getting him mad. And he's not having too much fun. At least that's the goal. The madder they get, you know, the happier I was.
Is it happiness though, or is it just like weird pleasure?
Boredom. Like, I work in a factory.
Yeah, it's like a victory though.
No.
Was for me sometimes, because it was like, I got you told. Listen to how sharp and clever. You know what I mean? But it wasn't really true happiness, because it's just, it's so empty and you know it's coming back around for you eventually.
I don't even think I was mature enough to think it through too much. I thought, I'm in a boring factory and warehouse. Everything's pretty much monotonous here. This is just killing time and it's at his expense, but we're having fun. Four of us are having fun, one guy ain't. So this is the trade-off, and hopefully I can take it when he comes back around on me. But anyways, one of my guys who was considered a friend one day, he says that me, I explained it to him. He was all mad and didn't want to talk to me. And I said, you know, we're just having fun doing that or whatever. And he goes, yeah, but why would you want to ruin somebody's day and get somebody mad? You've seen how mad I was getting. Why would you want to do it? Why ruin somebody's day just so you can have fun? Pretty much right after he said that, I made the adjustment. I'm not going to say I don't do it anymore, but I slowed way down on that. I don't do too much of that anymore. I used to do a lot of that, and I've slowed that way down. Just based on that one time he said that made me think about, like, yeah, why am I doing that? And I don't need to do this to have fun. There's plenty of other things I can come up with. You know, I can come up with other things I have fun. We can still joke around, but I can even make fun of myself. What, I got to make fun of him?
Right. It's like, why do you want to make someone feel like that? And that's kind of makes you realize, oh my goodness, in the moment, that kind of makes me a weak person, you know, or the not a weak person as much as the behavior is really weak. And I didn't realize it.
Yeah. Yeah. That guy did me a favor. I'm instantly seeing the error of my ways and turned it around. So I still think about that guy all the time. He taught me other lessons too. That was a good lesson for me. I had been doing that for a lifetime. So at that point I was in my 30s. So.
But again, it's that having the revelation, seeing the error of your ways and not just spitting it back at that person or thinking how you justify it. Well, it's just how I am, or I have a reason for this. So seeing that error is really good. And then, you know, when you have that ridicule, and I also had a lot of social anxiety from it. I don't know if you have that either, but I just don't do well in groups and on teams. I mean, I can get along fine with people, and I am fine to a degree when it comes to being outgoing and engaging, but I tend to be a loner and like to spend time alone. And I don't know if that's a result of coming up around so many people and it was a lot of dysfunction. So I had to pull away to get quiet and feel sane or not, but it's just how I am. And I had a therapist ask me one time, I said, people always misunderstand me for an extrovert. And he said, well, that's because you're not shy when you're in a conversation. But how do you recharge your batteries? Alone or connecting with people? And I was like, oh my goodness, alone, running or walking or sitting and reading. And he said, that's an introvert. It's how you kind of recharge yourself. So anyway, all of that said, I had a lot of issues of social trauma and terrible social anxiety where I couldn't, a lot of times, I would put up those defense mechanisms of being sarcastic with people or being in on situations that were maybe toxic, and then, or leaving parties or not showing up because I just couldn't handle a lot of social contact. I had just a lot of social trauma, and I had to come back to realizing whether it's I'm being ridiculed or even if I show up to a situation and I'd have these fantasies of everyone there hating me and chasing me down the street with like torches and flames. You know how we exaggerate, like I'm going to have some humiliating life and death thing happen. Your anxiety just lies. I started having to heal my life and come back to the point of whose opinions truly count. I can work things out to an extent with people that I'm encountering, aggravating people even. I can make it my own problem to solve. But when it comes down to it, I always have a baseline of whose opinions truly count to me. And that circle's really small. It's people I'm in constant communication with and that I care about. You know, because in the long run, if I were to be in hospice, a lot of people that I'm even worried about, they're not going to be sitting at my bedside of my deathbed. Or if it were my son, you know, were to, God forbid, pass away, they're not who I would call first. Or if crisis hit and the house burned down or I had to move, no matter what happens, if I'm late on my bills, whose opinion truly counts? Does it count outside of the people in my small social circle that are aware and present and safe in my heart or not? And I heard this quote and I wrote it down and saved it and I've applied it since. And it's kind of a Goggins mindset, David Goggins. If you haven't heard of him, we've talked about him before. Look him up. He's awesome. But he's a little vulgar, but his points are well driven home. When you've gone through the depths of despair and you've faced yourself, you've battled your own history, grief, faults, all your pathologies and weaknesses, you're no longer really concerned with the opinions of those who haven't. So that's kind of like, the further along you get in working things out, whether it's in the gym and you gain confidence that way, or you overcome terrible struggles of dysfunction, poverty, divorce, whatever, the further you get into accomplishing those things, you stop really caring about the opinions of people that weren't a part of your process or haven't done any of that kind of work on themselves. I mean, I don't know about you, but I can't spend too much time with people that aren't self-aware and doing at least some level of self-examining and self-improvement. You don't have to be on my same path and you don't have to even be impressive. But if you're locked out of all of that, we tend to kind of lock horns. So anyway, what are your thoughts on any of that?
I'm a loner too, but for like completely different reasons for you. I was like a only child and then like a latchkey kid. My parents were too worried about their things and they got divorced and you know, they were passing me off whoever it was convenient for. So they weren't really taking too much interest in being a parent. So I was just kind of on my own about it, whatever. And I just got used to doing it that way, I think. And I can't have too many people around or whatever. So like that vacation you were on, would not be my idea of a vacation going with a bunch of people in a house like that. I would really struggle. So I can really relate to that. I want to tell you about one thing I think about a lot. It's sort of on the subject, but there's a Duke study. I try to think about this every day and maybe talk about some of our morning routines to get our day started. Does that sound all right? So the Duke University, they do a study. I try to just think about this occasionally or whatever, just kind of in my notes or whatever. So they did a whole study on this and they taught a class on it and a lot of research went into it. But and these things just make sense when you listen to them. So 8 factors for happiness is absence of suspicion and resentment. Nursing a grudge was a major factor in unhappiness. Now, obviously, that's true. Okay. And then like we talked about before, not living in the past. An unwholesome preoccupation with old mistakes and failures leads to depression, just like we talked about. Not wasting time and energy fighting conditions you cannot change. Cooperate with life instead of trying to run away from it. Like Bruce Lee said, be like water. So I try to, that one, I got all these I got to work on, but that one for sure. I always want things to go exactly the way I want them to go. When they don't go, I act like it's some big failure setback when it's really not, it's nothing. And if you go out 15 minutes, if you go out 5 days, if you go out 5 months, I mean, just think about what this is really going to be, whatever just happened. It's not going to be nothing. Even in 15 minutes, especially if you go 5 days, now go 5 years, it's going to be nothing. It just seems big right at that moment. And then I think when you get older, this comes into play more on number 4. Force yourself to stay involved in a living world. Resist the temptation to withdraw and become reclusive during times of emotional stress as well. So, you know, I see a lot of people do that. And then five kind of goes along with that. Refuse to indulge in self-pity when life hands you a raw deal. Accept the fact that nobody gets through life without some sorrow and misfortune, which that is a big one for me too. I don't know. For a long while, whenever I had a misfortune, whatever, I would just think, get so mad about it. But after a while, it's like, well, you think this ain't just going to keep happening? You're just going to keep reacting like this? You're just going to keep going through life mad all the time? Dude, there's going to be a bunch of stuff coming up. You need to just deal with it and move on. It's not no big deal. And then six is cultivate the old-fashioned virtues, love, humor, compassion, loyalty. Obviously, those are good to do. And as I've gotten older, you know, loyalty and being a good friend or whatever has become way more important to me than it was when I was younger. So I have to have a loyal friend, and I have to be loyal to them. And then love, humor, and compassion, that's pretty obvious. That's definitely going to make you feel lighter. And lighter is a key word I like to stick in my head. I need to be lighter because I can be kind of heavy. And then don't expect too much from yourself. There's a wide gap between self-expectation and your ability to meet the goals you have set. Feelings of inadequacy are inevitable. That's a tongue twister. But yeah, I go through that. I'm pretty hard on myself. Number eight, find something bigger than yourself to believe in. Self-centered, egotistical people score lowest on any measure for measuring happiness.
That is for sure. You know, two things that stick out the most is the self-pity, because it is so, so toxic, and it doesn't solve anything, even if you're right. It doesn't lead you to solutions. You know, that was one of the rules I had for my son when he came to stay with us. He had gone through a season of intense, we had a lot of death in our family, and he was just breaking down from the despair of it. So when I brought him back here to take some time with us, one of the things I said was, you got a lot of things hitting you. I got this grief too, but you've got some other situations that are making it feel worse and unstable. So here's the thing. We're going to do these processes together and walk them out. It's on you to do it. I'm not going to carry your load, but I'm going to give you, you got to do what I say. And I don't mean do what I say because I'm trying to control you. I'm saying do the things I'm telling you to do that'll work and get you out of this despair. I've come out of a lot of despair and walked it out. And one of them was that you can have 5 minutes a day to feel sorry for yourself. Get down in that self-pity and feel sorry for yourself. Woe is me. Things are worse for me than anybody else. I don't deserve it. I'm the best person in the world. These are the worst circumstances. That's fine for 5 minutes. Then you got to get up and keep it moving and be productive. And I'm not saying I'm running you to the ground. Productive might be sit in a bathtub or take a nap, but you're not going to be beyond this 5 minutes of self-pity. And that was so helpful. And then the other one's higher power. That's really such a big, huge recovery necessity. You know, everyone kind of brings their own to when it's recovery settings. Mine's Christianity and the Bible, but that higher power, it takes it out of you and off of you and off your shoulders. I remember a man in a meeting saying, my higher power for me, where I'm starting at, because I'm so triggered by the concepts of church and God, he had a lot of bad experiences, but I can make peace with imagining for now, my higher power is a fishing trip I took with my grandfather. And it was such a great memory that he kind of, when he's all worked up and triggered and panicked and reacting, he sits down and goes back to that memory and feels peace come over him. So, you know, whatever it takes, finding your way to faith and something bigger than you, that is so profoundly helpful for getting you moving the needle forward when you're stuck. So I love those.
One more thought on that one. This sounds crazy, and but I think everybody knows it works. So like when you're really feeling bad or feeling down, even if life circumstances are horrible for you, you should be feeling bad. But one of the quickest ways, and sometimes it's just a mood thing as well, for me at least, but the quickest way I can get out of that when I pull myself out of, if I go do something for someone, I mean, and the bigger thing I do, the better this works. Just pull yourself out of your own self-centeredness and think about helping somebody or whatever. And what it does for you is immeasurable. It just breaks you out of that self-centered mode or whatever. And, you know, you realize, okay, everybody's got problems in this. And it could be just a little text to somebody, you know, that you haven't talked to in a while. Maybe even we're on bad terms, but you say something nice. And even though you don't really feel like doing that, you're doing that. Or, you know, it could be, you know, you could be paying it forward at McDonald's or in line at the store. It could be anything. Or you could go help somebody with their lawn. Just the bigger the service you do, I feel like the more the payback is and snapping you out of that. You don't think that would work because you're already feeling bad. You know, like, how's that going to work? But I assure you, try it sometime. It'll definitely work. At least it does for me. And, you know, I got it. The advice, just like I said, I'm just borrowing other people's ideas. And that was their idea. And you can see the sense to it. But in another way, you can look at it and be like, well, that doesn't make sense. I'm the one that needs help right now. It's like, no, everybody needs help. Come on, let's go.
It keeps you from having those ingrown eyeballs. And it just reminded me of a conversation I had when I met a few of my friends from high school for lunch. And one of them had been out on like a 3-day bender and just made kind of a fool of himself. And he was hungover and full of anxiety and humiliated and just suffering physically, emotionally, couldn't come out of it. And the other one was saying, you know, I've only had this happen in my life once or twice where I've been like that stupid drunk and made a fool out of myself. And both times what worked was doing something for somebody. And I, you know, I just thought that was so interesting. So he ended up actually putting together kind of like a bakery package for someone that he knew at work that had, I think their dog had died. And, you know, the hangover, all those symptoms passed. People forget all the embarrassing things you did. But that really started him moving out of that dark cloud rut. And, you know, different situations for everybody. But there's something so powerful to take your mind off you for a minute and find somebody else that you can show something kind to.
Yeah, let's talk about our morning routines. But I got one more thought. You said you had your son, you put him on that program.
Yeah.
Sometimes you got to talk about that. You're going to have to do another podcast about that and talk about that because that's really good.
Recovery design that I kind of wrote down for the book I'm writing. And then it ended up, I thought, well, he's coming back and he's got all these things going on. Let's just try it. And it ended up being powerfully healing for him because concepts of recovery work if you work them.
You have been listening to the Unhooked Podcast. Views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this episode by the guests belong solely to the guests and do not necessarily reflect those of the host or any affiliated organization or institution. Annie's books, Unhooked and Unbroken, can be found on Amazon, Cokesbury, BarnesandNoble.com, and wherever books are sold. You can find her work by searching Annie Highwater on Facebook. If you have enjoyed the Unhooked Podcast, please subscribe, share, and leave a 5-star review. We hope you'll keep coming back to listen to the Unhooked Podcast.